The following podcast is a presentation of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
I'm a professor of property law. I'm delighted to welcome you for the next couple of hours. You are doing yourselves an immeasurable kindness to the extent that you are committing to an initial visitation of certain subject matter within the domain of property law that is essential for purposes of your success this summer. We're going to be thinking today a little bit about concurrent estates. We'll be thinking a bit about adverse possession, and we'll be thinking a bit about land transactions. These topics are favorites on National Testing Day. They tend to appear with increasing frequency locally on the essay portion of the exam. We are going to relegate the final 10 minutes or so to a review collectively of a few of the past exam questions that are precisely on the course. And what I'm really hoping as a consequence of our time together is that you realize, wow, less than 2 hours, and I have the capacity already to answer with sufficient precision, more than sufficient precision, all exam questions. Hence, beginning at the beginning, I want to encourage you to please demystify this process known as the bar exam. It tends to work in interwar effect, even in the most confident of minds and hearts. It's a test. That's it. You've taken a test harder than this, and you've passed. This, by the way, is the first time in your professional lifetimes where getting the D is just fine. This is a pass-fail exam. The bar is not going to be set very high for purposes of passing the bar. Not high at all. Finally, for purposes of success, there are two essential ingredients. The first is memorization. This bar exam tests you on your capacity to memorize. Memorize what? Number two, generalizations. All that they can and will test you on are broad generalizations of law. Yes. Surrender your carefully honed and lawyerly instincts to want to overanalyze, not for these purposes. For that matter, to render the material memorable, what we're going to do is use some acronyms, maybe use some visuals, maybe even invoke a few songs, all by conscious design. You're being tested on your capacity to remember. Let's do it. On page one, we think about co-ownership, or it's known as the law of frontiers. In this regard, the examiner will tell you that there are three forms of co-ownership. The first of these is called the co-tenancy doctrine. Two or more own with the right of survivorship. That's what a joint tenancy is. Two or more people own Black Acre at the very same time with the right of survivorship. Number two, the tenancy by the entirety. This is a marital interest. It can only exist between H and W. It can only exist between husband and wife. It can't exist before the fact of marriage. It can't be created, mindful that marriage is pending. It is a marital interest. It resides only between H and W, husband and wife. Jot down, with the right of survivorship. With the right of survivorship. Number three, the tenancy in common. Two or more own with no right of survivorship. Two or more own with no right of survivorship. What more do you need to know about each of these three forms of co-ownership? Just a couple of points first about the joint tenancy. Distinguishing characteristics. Number one, when one joint tenant dies, his share goes to the surviving joint tenants. That's a remarkably efficient device. When one joint tenant dies, his share goes automatically to the surviving joint tenants. Number two, the joint tenancy is alienable, meaning you can transfer your interest while you're alive. The joint tenancy is alienable. It is not, however, divisible or descendable. It is not divisible or descendable. What does that mean? leave, it's not survivable. You won't be able to leave it to a stranger in your will. It's not descendable. It's not going to pass by descent or the statutes of intestacy. Why not? I would never know it right of survivorship. That's what you'll attest to. The joint tenancy finds two or more entities owning Blackacre with this automatic entitlement. The survivors take all. How do you create a joint tenancy? Well, the common law says it'll be somewhat hard. First, you need the four immunities. On page two. Survivorship. What do we accomplish now because we've resorted to this third party, the straw man? Now all four unities are present, including the unities of time and title. Thanks to the use of the straw, Dave and Paul are indeed at the same time in the very same instrument. Good. Let's get to the three. The examiners will ask you, how do you sever a joint tenancy? There are two ways to do it. First, severance and to sale. A joint tenant can sell or transfer her interest during her lifetime. Often the did she do that secretly? And the answer, contrary to basic instincts, perhaps is yes. Yes, even without the other's knowledge or consent. It is permissible for a joint tenant to engage in a somewhat covert or clandestine or less than open transfer. However, one joint tenant sale is going to sever the joint tenancy as to the seller's interest because it disrupts the four units. If one of our joint tenants is unilaterally, secretly or quite overtly, selling her share to another, she has now disrupted the four unities. Certain results flow from the premise that the four unities have now been disturbed. Here they are. To the extent that we started with more than two joint tenants in the first place. Oh, do you know what? We skipped something, yes? Yes? Did we skip something? Yeah? Tell me. But I'm so enamored with this construct, and I'm thinking ahead to what the next is. Where are we? Where did we leave off? Oh, very much. Who did you have for property, by the way, first year? Oh, various, various. You have a very good faculty here. You happy you went here? You should be. Because all three of them have a great reputation. It's a little late now. But your school has such a good reputation nationally, so good for you. And you are also now very good for you. Thank you. Thank you very much. All right, so we're talking about how a joint tenant sale messes with these four unities. Here's the immediate consequence. Thus, the buyer is a tenant in common. If, in fact, you see that someone has transferred his or her interest in a joint tenancy, secretly or otherwise, the entity to whom she has transferred has to be a tenant in common. That entity can't be a joint tenant because the four unities as to the whole of the joint tenants is not valid. To the extent, here it is, and this is the likely testing ground. To the extent that we started with more than two joint tenants in the first place, the joint tenancy remains in place. If you started with more than two joint tenants in the first place, the joint tenancy remains in place. As between those other non-transferring joint tenants. This comes up on the national testing day, usually as a two. We're noticing more and more as a three-part question. It's example two. O conveys Blackacre to B.B. Ross and Monica as joint tenants with the right of survivorship. Each owns one-third. Still at the bottom of the list. Each owns one-third, plus the right to use the whole. Each owns one-third, plus the right to use the whole. But now we get to example two continue on page four. Suppose now that Keaton Bank sells her investment to Jim, what now is the state of title? Phoebe's act severs the joint tenancy as to Phoebe's interest. Phoebe, in other words, has just disrupted the four unities as to Phoebe's interest. Ross and Monica still hold two-thirds as joint tenants. Ross and Monica still hold two-thirds as joint tenants, and Chandler holds one-third as their tenant in common. Suppose that later Ross dies, leaving behind his heir, Rachel. Now the bar examiners ask you, what's the state of the title? The answer, Monica takes Ross's share. Monica takes Ross's share. Thus, Monica now holds two-thirds with Chandler, who holds one-third. Monica and Chandler are tenants in common. Rachel takes nothing. We're still answering the question, how do you set a joint tenancy? Now we've got to make the point about equity. This will be tested this summer. In equity, a joint tenant's simple act of entering into a contract for the sale of her share will sever the joint tenancy. It will sever the joint tenancy as to the contracting party's interest. It will sever the joint tenancy as to the contracting party's interest. Why is it that the mere act of entering into a contract for the sale of your share works a severance as to that share? Well, it's because of the doctrine of equitable conversion. Equitable conversion. Once you've jotted those two words down, put a couple of stars next to them. Equitable conversion. It is a common thread in the property tapestry. Equitable conversion is a very lofty maxim. It says, equity regards as done that which ought to be done. Several important consequences in property law flow from that proposition. It's example 3. O conveys Wagacre to Ringo Paul John as joint tenants with the right of survivorship. This form of concurrency is the joint tenancy. You know it. It's a joint tenancy. Now we get to the On January 1, Ringo enters into a mere contract for the sale of his interest in the joint tenancy to George. Notice, the contract is entered into on January 1, but the closing will not occur until April 1. The examiners ask, when does the severance as to Ringo's interest occur and why? The correct answer choice on January 1. Under equitable conversion. That's the answer choice you pick. On January 1, under equitable conversion. Why? The joint tenancy in equity is deemed severed as to Ringo's interest from the moment that contract for sale is signed, no matter that the closing won't take place until April. Equity regards as done that which ought to be done. Severance is deemed to have occurred the instant that contract is legally consummated. What do you need to know about partition? In other words, dissolution of a form of co-ownership. Severance and partition. There are three variations on the partition theory. The first, partition by voluntary agreement, meaning peaceful termination. So suppose that we are joint tenants and we've come to the end of the road. It's time to move on. How do we dissolve our relationship? Well, hopefully we do it amicably. This is an option. Severance by voluntary agreement, peaceful, non-litigious route. By contrast, partition in kind, court action. So now, for better or worse, the parties find themselves in court. A court action for physical division of land. So now we're dealing with a court action for physical division of Blackacre, if in the best interests of all. That's what we mean by partition in kind. A court action for physical division of Blackacre, if in the best interests of all. Monty think partition in kind would tend to work best when Blackacre is sprawling acreage, for example, when Blackacre is a vineyard. When Blackacre perhaps is a large agricultural center. In other words, partition in kind, a forced action for physical taking up of the premises, works best in rural settings, in more agrarian settings. It works best when Blackacre is vast acreage. That's more susceptible to, in fact, a physical division. By contrast, there is a third variation on the partition or dissolution theme. It's called force to sale. This is also a court action. So now, for better or worse, the parties find themselves on the litigious path. This is a court action where the land is sold and the proceeds divided. So now the land is sold, the proceeds are divided. Again, if in the best interests of all. Land is sold, the proceeds are divided. Typically, they're divided up proportionally. If in the best interests of all. The forced sale tends to work best when Blackacre happens to be a building, Blackacre happens to be a home. Blackacre is not lending itself to any form of literal physical division. Certainly not if the parties can't get along well enough to have resolved this amicably in the first place. There's another way to sever a joint tenancy. It's a very peculiar one that the examiners harp on. It's called severance and mortgage. The rule: one joint tenant's execution of a mortgage, in other words, a lien on his or her share, is going to sever the joint tenancy as to that now encumbered or beleaguered share only in the minority of states. To follow what's called the title theory of mortgages. The execution of a lien on your share works a severance as to your share only in the minority of states to follow what we call the title theory of mortgages. By contrast, the majority of states follow the lien theory, L-I-E-N, the lien theory. The lien theory of mortgages, what is it? The majority of states following the lien theory of mortgages indicate that a joint tenant's execution of a mortgage on his or her interest will not sever the joint tenancy. It will not work a severance. And that makes better sense. This example four, the examiners pitch this typically as a two-part question. That's a good thing. It's an opportunity to answer quickly and correctly. 2 points. Paul, John, and George are joint tenants. Suppose now that Paul Morgan is interested in joint tenancy. They ask you, will this work a severance as to Paul's interest? You answer, in a minority jurisdiction to follow the title theory of mortgages, yes. In a majority jurisdiction to follow the lien theory of mortgages, no. This takes us then to the tenancy by the entirety. It is recognized in 21 states. 21 of the United States do allow for this form of co-ownership. How do you create it? Between H and W, husband and wife, with the right of survivorship. It can only exist between H and W, husband and wife, with the right of survivorship. In those states, too, in fact, recognize the tenancy by the entirety. It arises presumptively in any conveyance to H and W. It will arise presumptively in any conveyance to H and W, unless stated otherwise. So if they tell you that you're in a state to embrace the tenancy by the entirety, know that the presumption favors it, if in fact the conveyance has been made to husband and wife. Unless, of course, the grantor has stated otherwise. The tenancy by the entirety is a very protected form of interest, derivative of the fact that it is indeed sacred interest that exists only within the confines of the marital interest. Hence, the relevant slogan to embrace here, can't touch this. On page 7, means two things. First, with regard to creditors. Creditors of only one spouse can't touch this tenancy. Creditors of only one spouse can't touch the tenancy. You're a creditor with regard to only one of the spouses. Too bad, so sad, but you're not going to be able to get your hands on this specially protected marital interest in the quest and to be made whole. Can't touch this has something to do with unilateral conveyance. Neither tenant acting alone can defeat the right of survivorship by unilateral transfer to a third party. It's example 5. Tony and Carmela, married to each other, all Blackacre as tenants by the entirety. Tony talking then secretly transfers his interest to Uncle Junior. What does Uncle Junior have? Nothing. You remember the guidepost. You can't touch this. Unilateral transfer isn't actionable. The last form of coercion, we call it the tenancy in common. Number one, each co-tenant owns an individual home. And each has a right to possess the whole. Each owns an individual part, and each has a right to possess the whole. Number two, each interest is descendable, divisible, and alienable. What does that mean? Each interest is descendable, divisible, and alienable. Each interest is descendable. It'll pass by the statutes of intestacy if its holder happens to die intestate or without a will. Each interest is divisible. You can leave it to another, even a stranger, in your will. Each interest is, of course, alienable. You're entitled to transfer by sale or otherwise your share during your lifetime. In other words, there are no survivorship rights. There are no survivorship rights between tenants in common. Number three, the presumption favors the tenancy in common. Remember I indicated the common law makes it awfully difficult to create a joint tenancy because joint tenancies with the right of survivorship avoid probate. Hence, the presumption favors the tenancy in common. On the exam, locally as well as in the county, in addition to expecting to be familiar with each of the three forms of co-ownership, the bar examiners are going to expect some conversancy on your part with regard to the rights and duties of co-owners. We need to talk about these, and we'll do so in the context of those teen idols of long ago, Greg and Marcia Brady. Greg and Marcia own Blackacre, let's suppose, as tenants in common. Why is it a tenancy in common? Because they've got very disparate shares. Greg contributed 90% of the purchase price, and Marcia a mere 10%. That disparity in respective shares renders this a tenancy in common. Remember, joint tenants have to take with the four unities, including presumptively identical, equal, undivided interests. So we use the rubric of the tenancy in common, but the rules that we're about to work through together are applicable to all of the forms of co-ownership. This just happens to be a tenancy in common. Number one, possession. Suppose that Greg takes a can of white paint and divides up the premises. Marcia, he says, you can use and enjoy that 10% on that side of the line and only that. Are Greg's actions permissible? No. Each co-tenant is entitled to possess and enjoy the whole. That's the virtue of co-ownership. No matter that Marcia contributed an undivided 10% share, she still gets the benefit of the use and enjoyment of the whole. Indeed, if one co-tenant wrongfully excludes another from possession of the whole or any part, he has committed wrongful ouster. He has committed wrongful ouster. And here, of course, we engage in the requisite reality check. In reality, would Greg Brady ever ask Marcia Brady? And we know, of course, the answer is no. To the extent that you watch the Bradys in their second and third incarnations, I watched the original incarnation. So easily intuit, couldn't you, that there was more than brotherly, sisterly love? They look at each other very lovingly. They hang on to each other in your life. It's not a husband. What about rent from a co-tenant who happens to be an exclusive possession? Suppose this time that Marcia happens to leave Black Panther voluntarily for a 3-month tour of Europe with that cheerleading squad. When she gets back, she demands rent from Brett for the 3 months in which the poor guy happens to be in exclusive possession. Will she prevail? No. Absent Alistair, a co-tenant in exclusive possession is not liable to the others for rent. So unless he had actually ousted Marcia, Greg would not be held to task. He would not be accountable to Marcia for rent during the 3 months where, after all, Marcia voluntarily relinquished possession. But this time, what about number 3, rent from third parties? Greg leases Blackacre's basement to Alice, who is a mere tenant. Is Marcia entitled this time to a portion of the rental income? Yes. A co-tenant who leases all or part of the premises to a third party must account to his co-tenants. He must account to his co-tenants, giving them their fair share of the rent. Giving them their fair share of the rent. Greg has to account to Marcia. He has to afford her fair share of the rent. What is her? Her fair share is equal to the undivided interest that she happens to hold. So Marcia is entitled to 10%, Greg gets to keep 90%. That leads to adverse possession. Suppose that Marcia, so taken by that family trip to the Grand Canyon, decides to stay there for the next 20 years. In her absence, would Greg be able to acquire title to the whole through adverse possession? No. Unless he ousted Marcia, one co-tenant in exclusive possession for the statutory adverse possession period cannot acquire title. He cannot acquire title to the exclusion of the others. He cannot acquire title to the exclusion of the others. So why wouldn't I be able to acquire title to the exclusion of adverse possession, mindful that Marcia did leave voluntarily for a protracted stay at the Grand Canyon. Well, we get to page 9. Why not? Why no adverse possession? Because the hostility element. The hostility element of adverse possession is absent. There's no hostility because there was no ouster. The hostility element of adverse possession, something we'll get to, is missing. No hostility because there was no ouster. What about carrying costs? What are Marcia and Greg's respective responsibilities with respect to these so-called carrying costs? Property law says each co-tenant is responsible for his or her fair share of carrying costs. By carrying costs, the bar examiners are thinking about taxes and mortgage interest payments. Taxes and mortgage interest payments. Based upon his undivided share, each co-tenant has to pay carrying costs, typically tax payments, mortgage interest payments, based upon his undivided share, meaning Greg is responsible for 90% of the carrying costs and Marcia a mere 10%. What about repairs? Suppose that a football is thrown in Marcia's direction. Thankfully, it misses Marcia, thereby preserving her teen modeling career. But it does happen to go through Blackacre's front window. Marcia has fixed the window. She now demands contribution from Greg. Will she prevail? Yes. The repairing co-tenant enjoys a right to contribution, a right to contribution for reasonable repairs. Marcia enjoys a right to contribution for reasonable repairs, provided that she has told the others of the need. So in fairness to Greg, provided that she told Greg of the need. To say that Marcia enjoys an affirmative right to contribution for any reasonably necessary repairs, provided in fairness to Greg that she told the other, Greg, of the need, is to say that Greg must contribute 90% and Marcia 10%. What about improvement? Suppose that Greg were Marcus. And to add insult to his injury, Marcia is gleefully awaiting his return. She's standing at the front door expectantly. She exclaims, "Oh, Fred, you'll never believe it, but the absolute grooviest thing happened today. My idol, Davy Jones, came to see me, and he left behind 12 life-size posters. Come see, our wallpaper could dine with them." "Oh, and you owe me, Fred Brady, for your failure of the cost of my improvement."
Regis was by himself.
He asks us, "Will she succeed?" And thankfully for him, we answer reassuringly, "No. No. Shut this down. One co-tenant's quote improvement, close quote, could be another's nightmare." That's the big idea. Improvement is a very subjective notion. One co-tenant's so-called improvement could be another's nightmare. Property law heeds this wisdom. An improvement to you could be disaster to me. Hence, during the life of the co-tenancy, there is no right to contribution for, quote, improvements, close quote. No right to contribution for so-called improvements. However, at partition, when it comes time to dissolve the relationship, the improver is entitled to a credit. Marcia would get a credit equal to any increase in value due to her efforts. At partition, when parties get to the end of the road, Marcia receives a full credit equal to any increase or appreciation to the premises value attributable to her initiated. More likely for Marcia, the downside. At partition, the so-called improver bears full liability for any drop in value, due to her efforts. And it's far more likely that the unilateral act of the Davy Jones wallpapering will work as a crime in value. That gets us to the property law is firm in declaring that a co-tenant must not commit waste. There are three kinds of waste that you need to know about. The first is voluntary. Under the word voluntary, jot down overt destruction. Voluntary waste, meaning overt destruction. You are liable for voluntary waste as a co-tenant. If one day, in a fit of anger, you kick in one of the blackboard's walls, or alternatively decide unilaterally to wreak havoc with part of the landscape. Those are overt acts of destruction. By contrast, there is permissive waste. Under the word permissive, jot down neglect. Permissive waste is a pattern of neglectfulness. So, for example, you'll be held to task for permissive waste if, during the time that you, co-tenant, were in exclusive possession, you noticed that Blackacre's kitchen ceiling was occasionally leaking, but you did nothing! And your pattern of remiss or neglect over time ultimately caused that Blackacre ceiling to come crashing down. Your pattern of neglect is called permissive waste. It will be actionable. The last kind of waste is ameliorative. Under the word ameliorative, jot down unilateral changes that enhance value. Unilateral changes that enhance value. So you and I are co-owners. I leave one day for a business trip. On my return, I'm horrified to find that the beloved Walnut Grove has now made way for a boxing pavilion. You saw Mickey Rourke in the wrestling, and you decided, this is my dream. I want to be a boxer instead. You build the pavilion, and you argue in your defense, hey, building the pavilion, it's actually going to be enhancing Blackacre's market value. That's no defense. Your unilateral actions are ameliorative waste. We won't allow unilateral changes, no matter that they actually increase the premises value. No changes unless the other co-owners know, consent. Finally, what more do you need to know about rights and duties vis-a-vis co-owners? Simply a reminder about partition. Any joint tenant or tenant in common always has the right to bring an action for a partition. Jot down here, see page 5. Page 5 of this outline revisits the three variations on the partition theme. Let's talk about adverse possession. Basic concept. Possession for a statutorily prescribed period of time can, if certain elements are met, ripen into title. Oh my goodness. Do you remember this? Did you have property as first semester students? Or is it second? The second semester? I'm confessing to. I'm in the 5-credit course right now. Do you remember how tendering you were as first year students? Oh my goodness. It feels like a lifetime ago, yes? But I just finished adverse possession with the class, and someone made the connection and started with possession is 9/10 of the law. And was, yes. And, oh, it's such an earnestness that resides there. Continuous means uninterrupted for the statutory period. Uninterrupted for the statutory period. It's got to be open and notorious, meaning possession that the usual owner would make. Possession that the usual owner would make, given the circumstances. That's open and notorious. The sort of possession that the usual owner would make, given the circumstances. A, the possession has to be actual, meaning the entry must be literal. We're looking for a literal entry. And H, it's got to be hostile, meaning without the true owner's consent. Without the true owner's consent. Circle the note. The possessor's subjective state of mind is beside the point. On the exam, it won't matter that the possessor thought she was on her own land all along. It won't matter that the possessor knew she was encroaching on the property rights of another. This is an objective calculation. Only two other points that you need to know about adverse possession, and then we'll take it to work. First, tacking on page 11. One adverse possessor may tack on to his time of the lens, his predecessor's time, so long as there is privity. We will allow tacking to satisfy the requisite statutory period of limitations, so long as there is privity between the possessors. Privity is satisfied by any non-hostile nexus. Any non-hostile nexus, such as blood, contract, deed, will. Privity is satisfied by any non-hostile nexus. What kind? Well, on the exam, it's usually a blood relationship or a contractual relationship. It'll be a deed. Sometimes it might be a will having passed. Tacking is not allowed, however, when there has been an ouster. No tacking when there has been an ouster. It's example 6. Owen Flatbaker in 1980, when A entered adversely, A was on her way to meeting those elements of adverse possession when in 1986, Mr. X ousted her. X stays there through 2000. If this jurisdiction, you're told, has a 20-year statute of limitations, in 2002 owns Blackwood. Oh, ouster defeats privity. That's the answer choice you pick. Oh, why? Ouster defeats privity. Meaning, no tacking is allowed. We won't allow X, a wrongdoer who ousted A, the benefit and virtue of being allowed to tack on to his time with the lamp, his predecessor ousted party A's time with the lamp. We won't allow a wrong to, in fact, yield to a right. What about disabilities? The statute of limitations won't run against a true owner afflicted by a disability at the start of the adverse possession. At the start of the adverse possession. Once you've jotted down those words, circle them. At the start of the adverse possession. That's how this will be tested. Common disabilities include insanity, infancy, imprisonment, so the clock won't run against a true owner afflicted by any one of typically statutorily prescribed listed disabilities. So long as the malady existed on the owner's part at the inception of the adverse possession. Hence, it is example 7. O owned Blackacre in 1980 when A entered adversely. In 1990, O went insane. In 2000, O recovered. Our jurisdiction has a 20-year statute of limitations. In 2000, two owns Blackacre. A, assuming, of course, that she's met those COA elements for adverse possession. O can't claim the benefit of the disability because he wasn't suffering from it. He wasn't suffering from it at the start of the adverse possession. He wasn't suffering from it at the start of the adverse possession. Excellent. Here's what we'll